Hi, welcome to this episode of DebtWired. I'm Dawn Grocock, Senior Legal Analyst for DebtWire Europe. On this episode, we speak with Freshfields' Craig Montgomery and Lindsay Higston about Adler's landmark restructuring plan, considering some of the key takeaways for future UK restructuring plans. Craig and Lindsay, thank you for joining us today. German real estate group Adler's UK restructuring plan secured its place in legal history recently as the English Court of Appeal allowed an appeal by a group of dissenting noteholders, overturning the High Court's April 2023 decision to sanction the plan. This is the first time the UK's restructuring plan tool, which came into force in 2020, has been considered by the appellate court. So to kick off, please could you give us a brief recap of what the Adler plan sought to do?
Yes, thank you, Dawn. As you said, Adler is a German real estate company with a significant liquidity issue. And the group doesn't intend to continue its business, so it's in the process of winding down. And it has six series of unsecured notes, which have staggered maturities from 2024 through to 2029. And without more liquidity, which would require, for example, the granting of new security, the group would have to enter a liquidation in Germany, in which circumstance all of the notes would receive some recovery, so they're not out of the money, but it wouldn't be an ideal recovery that you would get if they had more time to wind down the business in a more orderly way. So the group tried to do that through a consent solicitation unsuccessfully, and so then came to England to use the restructuring plan to achieve that restructuring, potentially without the consent of all of the series of noteholders. So what the plan does is make various amendments to the terms of the notes and intercreditor arrangements to allow new money to come in and provide that stable platform for asset realizations. Now, that required the deferral of the first 2024 maturity for a year in order to give that initial runway to allow those realizations to begin. But otherwise, the maturity dates of the existing notes were maintained. And the intercreditor provided for a ranking of first the new money, then those 2024 notes, which had been deferred for a year beyond their contractual maturity, and then all the other notes on an equal basis. So that's effectively what the plan does.
Thank you, Craig. An essential issue to the appeal was the so-called pari passu principle of distribution. Perhaps you could briefly explain what this is and why Lord Justice Snowden ultimately found that Adler's plan fell foul of it.
Thanks, Dawn. I'm happy to take this one. I think the first thing it's worth noting is that this debate came up because the company was trying to invoke cross-class cramdown. Craig mentioned there were six series of notes here. Five of them had voted in favour of the plan as distinct classes. The sixth class of note holders, the 2029s, 62% had voted in favour, but that wasn't enough to achieve the statutory majority of 75%, which is required. And so basically the court was asked to cram down across the class. Where there is cross-class cramdown happening, there's basically three hurdles that the company need to get over for the court to allow that. First of all, you need at least one class with a genuine interest to have assented to the plan, with a genuine economic interest. And that was no issue here. As I said, five classes had consented. You then need to demonstrate that the dissenting class here, the 2029s, are no worse off under the plan than in the alternative. Here, the valuation evidence suggested that they should be better off under the plan. But what the Court of Appeal goes on to say is that is not enough. The satisfaction of those two conditions to cross-class cram down is not enough. You also need the court to decide it's appropriate to sanction in its discretion. And this is where the pari passu principle came into play in a big way in the Court of Appeal. Because what the court said is where the court is applying its discretion, it's going to look at what's known as the horizontal comparison. And sometimes that's referred to as a fair distribution of the restructuring surplus. But essentially, that is getting at the same thing, which is we have to look at the relative treatment of the different classes of creditors under the plan and whether that is consistent with their relative treatment in the relevant alternative. So just to explain that a bit more here, as Craig said, the relevant alternative was a German insolvency process where all of the notes would have been accelerated and they all would have had the same maturity effectively. What the plan did, again, as Craig said, was maintain the staggered maturity dates so that you still had these notes maturing over between 2025 and 2029. The High Court at first instance, said that that was actually okay, because on the valuation evidence, it looked like all of the note holders should be paid off in full. And therefore, even though some of them were being paid later, they were all going to get pari passu treatment because they were all going to be paid out in full. What the Court of Appeal said was no, fundamentally, that's not correct, because the risk of a shortfall was not being borne equally. The risk of a shortfall in the assets was all falling on the longer dated note holders. And so this is why it was found to breach pari passu. And it was on that basis, more than anything else, that the court overturned the sanction order on appeal.
Thank you, Lindsay. And so why was it okay for the 2024 notes to be afforded priority and for a chunk of the equity to be retained by the shareholder?
So in the case of the 2024 notes, as I mentioned at the start, they were effectively giving this additional deferral. So whereas everyone else was maintaining the date on which they were going to be repaid, the 2024 notes were giving this additional runway at the start of an additional year in order to allow those enhanced recoveries for the benefit of all the note holders to be realized. The Court of Appeal was content that they had provided that additional accommodation, and therefore that in this case, that was sufficient justification. Lindsay, if you've got anything to add on that.
Well, maybe I can take the equity questions. On the equity, about 22% of the equity was being allocated to the new money providers here, but the rest was staying with the existing shareholders. And one of the arguments run by the 2029 note holders that were challenging the plan was that that was not fair. The shareholders were giving nothing here, doing nothing here. Why should they retain the equity upside? The court found that actually the retention of the equity by the shareholders was not unfair in the sense that it did respect the order of priority that would apply in the relevant alternative, because the shareholders were not going to get anything out of this unless all of the note holders had been paid out in full. And that in that respect, it wasn't unfair in the sense that the shareholders were sort of getting an advantage over and above where they'd be in the relevant alternative. And the court was content with that. But the court did go on to say that the company had been arguing, I think the Court of Appeal described it as an adventurous argument, that not only should the court take the shares from the shareholders here, not only was it appropriate for the shareholders to lose the equity, but actually they had to lose the equity in circumstances where they weren't contributing anything and they shouldn't get anything in return for that. The court said that its provisional view on that was that it was unlikely to be possible to take away equity or indeed creditor claims from out of the money stakeholders for no consideration whatsoever, because that's a straight expropriation of rights, which is not expressly provided for in the legislation. So worth noting in passing in future cases that the provisional review of the Court of Appeal is you still need a bit of give and take, even with out of the money stakeholders.
Sure. And while he didn't provide an exhaustive list, Lord Justice Snowden did give a few examples of cases where it's likely that those creditors who do provide some benefits to get a restructuring over the line can legitimately walk away with an enhanced return or some additional benefits under the plan. And what kind of cases do you think we're talking about there?
So, as you said, Dawn, the court is wary of providing an exhaustive list here because it really will depend on the facts and circumstances. But what is pretty clear is that the established practice of giving priority to provision of new money required to turn around the business will be okay because the people who are providing the new money are creating the additional value. That's not a tick box black and white test, of course, because it depends on the circumstances. And we're already familiar with, you know, such questions as whether all creditors were afforded the opportunity to participate in the new money. What are the terms of the new money? Invariably, the court will hear on evidence that it's the only funding available and with details of what's been done to test that. And so that, you know, that's well trodden and will continue to apply, I would think. The interest rate for that new money is generally high, reflecting that fact. And there have also been cases where debt is elevated. So not only do you get priority for your new debt, but a pro rata amount of your existing debt, which is quite an interesting structure for the company because then effectively some of the compensation you'll get it for providing the new money is not at the expense of the company, but at the expense of other creditors who choose not to participate. So we've seen that in a couple of cases like EDNF Man, for example. So there was a warning shot from Lord Justice Snowden about those arrangements. He didn't say that you couldn't do it, but he did say that it would be likely to be highly fact sensitive. So people, I guess, will be exploring in future cases what fact sensitivity is and what's acceptable. But ultimately, it comes back to that test of overall fairness. So that's new money. And then also, for example, essential suppliers. So it's not uncommon to carve out trade creditors from any compromise, even though window cleaner or other supplier will be a pari passu unsecured creditor in a comparative liquidation, for example. Maybe that if you want to continue with your IT supply or supply of raw materials to the business, etc., then you're going to need to pay people, so you can't compromise them because you require them to make that ongoing service available. But again, that's fact specific, and we've seen this in some of the CVA cases where it's been challenged to say, well, you just put all of your trade creditors in here as essential and going to be paid in full, and the court has in some cases been prepared to go through them line by line and say, well, is it really right that this is essential supply, or is it really right that they wouldn't continue to supply if you didn't treat them in this way under the CVA? So those are the kind of factors the court will be taking into account.
Sure. And I think we've seen that in a number of restructuring plans where there's certain sort of essential suppliers who've been dealt with separately outside the plan. Okay. And following the Court of Appeals judgment, the court's approach to the exercise of its discretion to sanction a plan now will differ according to whether or not a cross-class clampdown is required. Would you be able to talk us through some of the additional points that the court now needs to consider when it's asked to impose a plan upon a dissenting class, i.e. a cross-class clampdown, as opposed to in a scheme of arrangement where there cannot be a cross-class clampdown, or a restructuring plan in which every creditor or stakeholder class has consented?
Yes, so it's been pretty clear for some time in all the cases we've had involving cross-class clampdown that the court's approach is going to be different in circumstances where cross-class clampdown is being exercised and where it's not. And in a restructuring plan where you're not using cross-class clampdown, then the test is the familiar one that we've seen in schemes, what's being called in the Adler case, the rationality test. So is the scheme or plan one which an honest and intelligent member of the class could accept? And it's a necessary element of that. The court there is not concerning itself with what is the best or fairest scheme. The court is going to be slow to substitute its commercial judgment for the judgment of the creditors who formed a majority of the class who were voting in their own interests. So the court isn't going to be interested in engaging in an exercise of, well, if you'd had a slightly different term here or had done, you know, did this aspect of the restructuring differently, then some creditors might be better off. It's sufficient that the class, if they're acting in their own interest, are the best judge of what they will and won't accept. And if they did accept it, the court isn't going to intervene in that and carry out a hypothetical exercise. But when we get into cross-class cramdown, the exercise is fundamentally different, isn't it, Lindsay?
It is completely different. And I think the Court of Appeal judgment really acknowledges that and brings it out in force, because where cross-class cramdown is being invoked, the whole point is that you have at least one class that has not approved the restructuring plan and it's being imposed on them by the company and by other creditor groups. And those other creditor groups, by definition, do not have sufficient commonality of interest with the dissenting class. That's why they're in different classes, because their rights and interests differ. And so fundamentally, the nature of what the court is doing by binding a dissenting class is completely different to where it is binding the minority within a class that has majority approved the plan. And I think that's what the Court of Appeal judgment really brings out in a forceful way. And so in that context, what we're told is that the rationality test is not going to be that relevant. The question is not really whether an honest and intelligent member of the class would have accepted this plan, because of course they haven't. The court also says that the level of support, the level of overall support amongst the assenting classes, doesn't really tell us anything either, because again, their interests are not sufficiently aligned with the dissenting class. The level of support within the dissenting class may be relevant. So here, 62% had approved, including some non-crossholders. So you can place some weight on that. But again, the court cautions us that we shouldn't ignore that the statutory requirement is 75%. And if you just accept 62% as a matter of right, then clearly you're sort of undermining the statutory test. So whilst you can take into account the level of support, it's not going to be determinative. And so fundamentally, where cross-class cramdown is invoked, the key focus of the court is going to be on the horizontal comparison I described earlier, whether the relative treatment of the different classes is and aligned with the relevant alternative.
Thank you. And finally, I think we've got time for just one more question today. Lord Justice Snowden dished out some words of warning for proponents of future plans who may be tempted to leave matters, as he said, down to the wire and rush through plans. What should we take away from the judgment in terms of the procedure for future restructuring plans?
As we expected, the judgment has had some choice words for parties who, as the judge said, either by oversight or design are running matters down to the wire, as you said. And the court recognises that time pressures may well be driven by external factors. So he gave the example of the Virgin Active gyms restructuring plan, where the difficulties were being caused by the COVID crisis and people not obviously going to the gym, so largely outside of the control of the parties. And in those cases, the court will continue to be accommodating, because it's long been a principle that schemes and, by extension, restructuring plans are urgent business, that the court will accommodate on a shorter timetable than you might expect for a piece of litigation, for example. But if the parties simply leave it too late to start negotiating, when you've got a foreseeable maturity coming up that the company is going to struggle to meet, or they just spend too long negotiating and leave too little time for a proper process, then the court said they can have little plaint if the court decides to adjourn hearings and take whatever time it requires to give a decision. And we've already seen some of that before Adler in the cases like Aggregate and McDermott, where the sanction hearings on the company's timetable would have taken place in the autumn, and the company, once a challenge was raised, is going to push that out to February in order to accommodate a timetable for provision of information to the challengers, for them to be able to instruct experts, and for those experts to produce reports and confer with the other experts. And effectively, what the court is trying to do here is balance the urgency of the situation and the company's liquidity needs with the need as much as possible to allow a challenger the benefits of a full litigation process. And that's never going to be the full process that you would get in a piece of ordinary high court litigation, which would take years, but it is more than the timetable that we've been accustomed to see for schemes and restructuring plans, which is to do stuff very quickly. So I think the sort of first immediate effect probably of the Adler judgment is going to be that we will see companies having to think ahead a bit more, start to parallel track their contingency planning in a way that maybe companies haven't necessarily done. And similarly, challengers, if you have a challenge to a restructuring that's being proposed, getting in at an early stage, making the request for the documents that you want, and the company would be expected to be accommodating on that, because the judge also had criticisms around the approach to disclosure and further reinforced the need for companies to provide information that underpins valuation evidence, for example, in a timely fashion so that it can be properly interrogated. And then there was also this question of the appeal. So in this case, the judgment was appealed, but there was no stay of the restructuring. So the restructuring of Adler has been implemented. And Lord Justice Snowden said that in future, if an appeal is contemplated, then the appellants should be raising the question of a stay with the judge. And so all of that process would need to be taken into account in deciding the timetable, you know, in advance of running out of cash. I think that last point is probably going to be difficult in most cases, because a stay would normally involve a cross undertaking in damages. And it's quite difficult to see, when you're talking about a restructuring involving billions of dollars of debt, that anybody's going to be willing to give a cross undertaking in damages in return for a stay, because the consequences of being unsuccessful then on the appeal would be very material. So those are the procedural points. And I think there's a common theme here, and Lindsay may have a comment on this as well, that it's a continuation of a theme that we've seen And there's the thread of both of these procedural points and some of the substantive points going through the cases. And so we see this as less of a revolution in restructuring plans and more of a coming of age of the restructuring plan, where you've had some of the early cases, and we've had quite a few of them now, obviously, and where these principles have started to be established. And now it's helpful to have the Court of Appeal look at it, you know, take a step back, because not all of the points that were addressed were actually directly relevant to Adler, but it's a tour of the issues that have arisen generally in restructuring plans, and set out some broad principles that will give greater degree of certainty both to companies that are proposing plans as to where the guardrails are, but also to people who are challenging as to what tests they'll have to meet on challenging it, and what they can expect in terms of time to make the challenge and documents, etc., to help them to do that. So it's helpful in that sense. And I think that we continue to see the restructuring plan be the tool of choice for this sort of restructuring in the coming years.
Yeah, I mean, I'd completely agree with that. I think that the Court of Appeal has helpfully summarised and clarified a lot of the principles that were starting to emerge and develop in the case law anyway. But this has brought real focus to how we should be thinking about fairness in the context of cross-class cramdown. And the procedural points are interesting, and I think will lead to a shift in terms of how early you need to start thinking about a restructuring plan, or could lead to a bit more creativity around creating more time in the timetable. Because, of course, one of the issues we have here is the moratorium process that was introduced at the same time as the restructuring plan has perhaps not proven to be as useful as had been anticipated. And so you do kind of get to these issues where there's a maturity, there's not an obvious way to stay that maturity, and it creates all this urgency. And so it'll be interesting to see if practitioners start to come up with more creative solutions to how to create more time, given the direction of the court here.
Thank you, Craig and Lindsay. Thank you so much for your insights. We could probably talk about the Adler judgment all day, but unfortunately, that is all we've got time for today. And to our audience, thank you for listening to DebtWired. You can download or listen to more episodes of DebtWired on Apple or Spotify.